Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
And a good afternoon to you all. Happy Wednesday as we bid farewell to 2025. What a year it has been, and I don't know about you, but for us here at Ave Maria Radio, this year went very, very fast. And before we know it, we're going to be bidding farewell to 2026 as well. As we have been doing the last few days, we are continuing our year in review here at Ave Maria in the Afternoon, looking back at some of the top interviews of the year. And going to spend the majority of today talking about one of the things that really does matter most, and that is the Scriptures, specifically the book of Matthew. Our guest will be Scott Hahn, who you know well for his many, many books he has written on Scripture and theology and culture and religion, etc. And he and his friends at the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology have started a new series of lectures on the Gospels that you can get at their website. We'll have that linked for you at avemariaradio.net. But the Gospel of Matthew is particularly important because it was the most widely diffused gospel in early Christianity. It was probably the most well-known in the early days of Christianity. And as, of course, the first book of the New Testament. So as Scott points out, it's the key that unlocks everything else that Jesus would fulfill. And we're going to take a deep dive into that gospel with Scott. Later on in this hour, or actually not later on in this hour, first in this hour, coming up in just a few minutes, will be a commentary from Marcus that looks at some news that came out regarding social media. The recently unsealed court documents show employees at Facebook's parent company Meta saying that they were aware of the adverse effects that social media has on kids' mental health. They called Instagram a drug and referred to themselves as pushers. And so Marcus has some thoughts on that, and that's something I wanted to think about just for a minute here. I'm of the somewhat younger generation. I remember when Facebook was first launching. I was in kind of high school and college when social media was really taking off. And I've always had the theory that, you know, there was kind of the internet age and then the social media age is almost something different where, as I said in the last hour, it gives everybody a voice. And that is both good, but that also comes with costs. And so in the last hour, we talked about the assassination of Charlie Kirk and how if you were a person that wanted to celebrate the assassination of somebody, there was a million different platforms. You could just go on there, type, and say whatever you wanted. And that's one of the downsides of social media. Also, we talked a lot about, you know, you've heard of the term FOMO, fear of missing out. When you log on to Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or TikTok or whatever else, and you see all your friends, of course, none of them are showing themselves, you know, sitting at home on the couch. They're all sharing their vacation, and they're sharing their exciting college news, and they're sharing, you know, cute photos with their girlfriend, all those things. And you see that and you think, oh, I'm clearly missing out because I'm sitting at home with nothing to do. Creates a very false impression of reality. As Al would always talk about, Al would talk about image versus reality, and social media really warps that. Lots of other ways that social media opens the doors for problems as well. And the more and more that now that social media has been around for, you know, 10 or 15 years, that it's really been a predominant fixture in our lives, a lot of the social science data is starting to come in. And we're seeing a lot of different laws being passed. So in Australia recently enacted a law, you have to be over 16 to be on social media. A lot here in the U.S., many schools, especially here in Michigan and across the country, are creating rules where it used to be, oh, your cell phone just has to be like turned off, or your cell phone just has to be in your pocket or whatever. And now the rules are being no smartphones whatsoever, period, full stop. And it's really one of those things where I think we could have seen this coming. And I think that a lot of parents who 15 years ago were being mocked for saying, oh, I don't want my kids to have a smartphone. Oh, I don't want my kids to be on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and TikTok, et cetera, are now being somewhat validated, saying, hey, you know what? They kind of had a point. And so Marcus is going to give us a Catholic understanding of this whole thing and some of the risks and the rewards of using social media. That's coming up in addition to talking with Scott Hahn, diving deep into the Gospel of Matthew. No news today, so let's get right to it with Marcus and have a very happy new year. You're listening to the 2025 Ave Maria in the Afternoon Year in Review.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. The New York Post recently revealed that Meta employees privately compared themselves to drug pushers because the company has been suppressing evidence of severe mental health harms to children. And frankly, none of this is surprising to us. It has all the subtlety of a fire alarm in a library because every adult with a pulse sensed this trajectory long before any whistleblower confirmed it. The story reads less like an expose, more like a belated acknowledgement of a cultural truth that most parents I know, pastors, psychologists, weary teachers have been articulating and practically screaming for years. Digital platforms promised global connection, but they've also been engineered with an architecture of compulsion that aims for neurological capture rather than human flourishing. And so these leaked comments from inside Meta merely expose the concealed inner logic of a system that functions through addictive mechanisms refined with clinical precision. We find ourselves today wrestling with a cultural ecosystem that amplifies the most fragile aspects of adolescent psychology. Psychologists have described for decades how adolescent development proceeds through impulsive identity formation and fluctuating emotional thresholds, which also means that environments heavy in stimuli will exacerbate insecurity, heighten anxiety, and distort self-concept. When Meta employees describe their product pipeline as a narcotics operation, the remark testified to a genuine understanding of what happens when the promise of infinite novelty meets the psyche of a population so young that their prefrontal cortex is still building. And the tragic irony arises when we recognize that society has noticed the symptoms, acknowledged it, long before engineers affirmed the truth, and we've yet to really get outraged about this as a society. Though the dimensions of the sociology of this come into focus, modern attention spans resemble the shattered remnants of what earlier generations possessed. And the digital ecosystem accelerates this fragmentation with relentless efficiency because the economic models of these platforms depends on the continuous capture of user engagement, which means every design choice aims towards more stimuli that can bypass reason and feed directly into the limbic system to trigger emotional outrage. Young people are enduring a cultural environment that rewards distraction, punishes stillness, facilitates outrage, and conditions their minds to expect gratification at the speed of a swipe. And in a lot of ways, this was historically unthinkable because studies are now revealing that these higher levels of anxiety, depression, body image distortion, sleep erosion, all of that data just quantifies what families have observed in living color for a long time. Meta that and Meta's emails actually force us to revisit thinkers who've warned us about this. One of my favorite books, Neil Postman, Amusing Ourselves to Death. Please pick up a copy and read it. It's a great, prescient dialogue as to a lot of the issues that we're facing. But he observed, societies will eventually trade intellectual seriousness for entertainment, and he suggested that the greater threat arises when citizens lose the capacity for sustained attention. We're already there. Postman's argument, framed during the age of television, is almost quaint. Televisions delivered a single stream of curated content. We were still in what we would call monoculture. Modern platforms deliver infinite individualized feeds shaped by microscopically tailored algorithms. At this point, this is a polyculture. Neil Postman's fears appear restrained when placed beside these glowing rectangles that now accompany children through every waking hour. Aldous Huxley, in Brave New World, predicted that populations would surrender their freedom to technologies that provided pleasure so effortlessly that resistance would appear irrational. I mean, he imagined a world utilized chemical euphoria to maintain social order. And although our devices dispense dopamine rather than, in this case, soma, the principle remains similar. Huxley believed that amusement itself could become the architecture of control. The fact that Meta engineers compared their product pipeline to narcotics shows a convergence between Huxley's fiction and our reality today. And this should cause us to at least pause, if not get outraged. George Orwell, 1984, he addressed a different threat, one driven by surveillance and explicit coercion. Our present digital environment operates through really voluntary participation, but the surveillance dimension has reached a level of intimacy that Orwell simply didn't think about. Children live within systems that monitor their behavior, their preferences, their movement, and social relationships through constant data extraction. Parents, those smartphones in your children's hands are right now mining very intimate personal data from your child to sell. Moreover, the algorithms that shape their feeds dictate their emotional climate. In fact, if your child is on social media, that platform has greater authority over their emotional control than teachers or you, the parents. That's why the dystopian writings of the 20th century converge in surprising ways. Digital culture blends Huxley's pleasure-driven manipulation with Orwell's data-driven observation. Our moment requires analysis that moves beyond pop culture panic and to enter into deeper reflection about the human person. Commentators on technology tell us that tools shape the user as much as users shape tools. Marshall McLuhan, for example, he captured this principle in his famous insight, "The medium shapes the message." This insight becomes painfully clear when we examine what children become after years within digital ecosystems. The mind becomes accustomed to instant stimulation. It loses interest in nuance and prolonged conversation, and it leads to difficulties in reading, focus, reflection, interpersonal depth, relationships. It goes on. In fact, sociologists have long noted that communities prosper when their members cultivate patience, delayed gratification, face-to-face communication. Social media destroys all of that because these virtues depend on environments that encourage contemplation rather than interruption. This phenomenon of infantilization of the young is also strikingly consistent. Adults who grew up with social media and with the digital world report diminished resilience, lower frustration tolerance, heightened emotional volatility. When children train their minds through constant reward cycles, they experience adulthood with weakened capacity for long-term projects, intellectual endurance, or sacrificial commitments. The platforms contribute to a cultural environment that sustains adolescence far beyond its biologically appropriate boundaries. The intellectual muscles don't grow, they atrophy, because children are not challenged. And the result is seen in classrooms, workplaces, households. The present revelations from that report reveal a deeper crisis. Parents receive criticism for allowing children unrestricted access to devices, but the platforms operate through design structures that exceed even the intuitive awareness of parents. Engineers understand their creations function through addictive cycles. They know the data. They know the direct correlation. So in a lot of ways, the moral burden rests on these developers and engineers, on the entire technological culture. But parents, we have to be on greater guard because of this. Society must reconsider its relationship to the tools it adopts. Technology can enrichen life when used with intentionality, but it can also distort humanity because it creates people who don't have a moral anchor. Institutions from ancient civilizations understood human flourishing requires formation in virtue, discipline, and community. This digital age constructs environments that reward impulsivity, self-display, emotional volatility. The meta documents reveal a corporate awareness that these effects existed, along with the willingness to bury the evidence to preserve public reputation and financial advantage. So the call to action is beyond legislation at this point. We need regulation, don't get me wrong. We do need regulation. But we also need tremendous cultural transformation. And Christians, we need to lead the charge to take this conversation outside of the walls of the church to everyone who needs to hear it. Children require environments that encourage them in virtue. That is the only way forward, because the instruments of our amusement have exceeded the prescient visions of Postman, Huxley, and Orwell. The time has now come to treat social media and the digital sphere with the seriousness it demands, because the future of our children's minds depend on our response. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
You like pizza? Me too. And for that, we can thank our friend, Tom Monahan. First, he starts with $900 and opens one pizza shop. Then it's worldwide, thousands of shops. But all this was just a warm-up for his greatest achievement yet. He built a university.
God inspired Tom to build up generations of men and women who have a hunger to reach the world for Christ. This place is Ave Maria University.
Visit avemaria.edu to see what's next.
Strained or broken relationships are a given in most of our lives. Friends fall away, siblings drift apart, children sever ties with their parents, and despite our best efforts, these painful fissures are difficult to mend. Hi, I'm Dr. Ray. If you want to learn how to communicate better with the difficult people in your life and be a more easygoing, more forgiving person, check out my book, How to Get Along with Almost Everybody. Check it out. And all my other books on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
Our world is filled with noise, work, screens, and endless demands. But Christ calls us to step away and listen. The nonprofit Revive app offers one-on-one virtual conversations with certified spiritual companions who help you deepen your relationship with God, discern His will, and find peace. If even the saints needed spiritual guidance, how much more do we? Your first two sessions are free. Download the Revive app today. That's R-E-V-I-V. And then the number 3.
You're listening to the Ave Maria in the Afternoon, 2025 Year in Review.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. The Gospel of Matthew is more than the first book of the New Testament. It is the key that unlocks the story of Jesus as fulfillment of the law, the awaited fulfillment of all that the prophets foretold, and the long-awaited kingdom of God. The St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology has put out a course, a foundational course, that guides its learners and viewers through Matthew's Gospel with clarity, depth, and pastoral insight. And it's taught by Dr. Scott Hahn, who joins us today. Dr. Hahn is a noteworthy biblical theologian, covenant theologian, a prolific author, and the teacher of this course on the Gospel of St. Matthew. Dr. Hahn, great to speak with you. How are you?
Oh, Marcus, dear brother, it's great to hear your voice. It's great to be back together again.
Likewise. I've been looking forward to this. I want to commend you on the insightful, thoughtful, and deeply enlightening course of the Gospel of Matthew that you've put out at the St. Paul Center. And so, to start with the big picture narrative, tell all of our listeners about the wonderful work that's being done at the St. Paul Center.
Yeah, thanks for asking, Marcus. We have a number of scholars who are colleagues of mine, both at Franciscan University as well as at the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology. And we've teamed up to do all four Gospels, and that's available, Emmaus Academy. Mm-hmm. And it's exciting because Dr. Shane Owens, a very dynamic teacher, is doing the Gospel of Mark. And then we also have Dr. Jeff Morrow, a convert from Judaism, doing the Gospel of Luke. It's brilliant. And then Dr. John Bergman will be doing the fourth gospel, the Gospel of John. And so I sort of lay a foundation by approaching the first gospel, the Gospel of Matthew. And you have effectively six lessons per gospel, an average of about 30 minutes each, by master presenters. And I would defer to my other three colleagues for being even superior teachers to my best. But together we are doing so many things for clergy and laity. We have three clergy conferences this year and every year. We also have a number of parish events and conferences for laity. Last week we sponsored 50 clergy converts for a retreat here. And I could go on and on, but stpaulcenter.com, you go there and you'll basically see all that we're doing to promote biblical literacy for lay people, biblical fluency for clergy, so that a whole new generation of Catholics will know what it means to read the Bible from the heart of the Church, especially in terms of typology.
Amen. And therefore, answering that question of Catholic biblical illiteracy, which has frankly confounded many converts who come into the Church from Protestantism, myself included. And so I want to say thank you for the wondrous work that the Center is doing, but particularly this lesson on the Gospel of Matthew. And so I want to just focus in on the beginning of these lessons. You narrate the fact that structurally Matthew is made up of five discourses, and that provides a kind of roadmap for navigating the entire book. Let's begin there.
Yeah, I mean, what you discover in the Gospel of Matthew is its distinctiveness.
Mm-hmm.
It overlaps a lot with Mark and Luke, somewhat with John, but it also is unique because you have five sermons distributed evenly throughout the whole Gospel. And so most people don't realize, I suspect, that Matthew's the only one of the four evangelists to give us the Sermon on the Mount.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the first of the five sermons in Matthew chapter 5, and it runs all the way to the end of chapter 7. But you also have what you call the mission discourse in chapter 10, and then you also have something that is unique to Matthew because he reserves the parables until chapter 13, when suddenly he lets loose with a third sermon by Jesus where you have seven consecutive kingdom parables.
Mm.
And it's so significant. It's an aspect of Matthew's own literary artistry, the symmetry of these five sermons. The fourth one is known as the church sermon,
mm-hmm.
or the church discourse in Matthew 18, because Matthew is the only one of the four evangelists to actually employ the technical term ecclesia,
yeah.
church, which he does three times in two chapters, Matthew 16, and then twice in Matthew 18.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the fifth and final sermon, which I playfully call the Sermon on the Mount of Olives. It's also known more famously as the Olivet Discourse. And just like the first sermon, the Sermon on the Mount, it goes three chapters, beginning in Matthew 23 through chapter 24 until the end of chapter 25, setting us up for the Passover and the institution narrative of the Eucharist that you find in Matthew 26. So you get a sense of artistry, symmetry, and balance because the first and the last of the five sermons are three chapters each,
mm-hmm.
whereas the middle three, chapter 10, 13, and 18, are all one chapter. Now, mm-hmm. obviously, the chapter divisions came much later, but in terms of verses and word
yeah.
count, there really is that symmetry that is obvious. And I think discovering that is the doorway into discovering that Matthew's genius is something that needs to be appreciated. I mean, you'll find scholars who have become agnostics who still comment upon Matthew's brilliance, his
right.
literary artistry. And you really see this when, in fact, you discover not only these five pillar sermons supporting the whole first gospel, but the way that he weaves the narrative
yeah.
through the discourses in a way that is, practically speaking, breathtaking. I think since most people have grown up hearing the Gospels since their childhood, they tend to hear them like you might hear an orchestra. You know,
right.
as a young person, you can't differentiate between the brass, the strings, the percussion, and the woodwinds. But once you learn to distinguish between Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the truth of this fourfold ensemble becomes positively symphonic. And you can see in a breathtaking way how the new was concealed in the old and how the old is revealed and fulfilled in the new. And Matthew really is the premier master of typology. That's what I love so much about this gospel.
And I'm glad that you brought that up because the way in which he appeals to typology demonstrates a real sense of immersion in his Jewish heritage, his Israelite heritage. And so you see hints of references, if you will, to rabbinic sources and texts, you know, like when he utilizes formulas, like you have heard it said, but I say to you, that's a kind of midrashim halakha, that formula that he's appealing to. And so he's bringing that out and showing that Christ is the new covenant fulfillment that all Israel has been hoping for.
That's so true. And that's worth really emphasizing because you have this emphasis on the Old Testament from the opening verse. I mean, the very fact that you have the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham, Biblos Genesos, the first two words, could just as easily be translated the book of Genesis. And so when you trace this genealogy back through David all the way to Abraham, of course, there's a period known as the exile. And most Jews who have been dispersed among the nations, as well as the Jews who are under Roman dominion and occupation there in Judea or Palestine, they have lost track of the Davidic dynasty. There just hasn't been a Davidic monarch now for practically five centuries. And so to discover, not only has God been faithful in the face of our infidelity, but he's also kept track of this this unbroken line of the Davidic monarchy. It just gives you a hope that, okay, this is just the foundation being laid. Now, most people would say a genealogy is probably the most boring part of the gospel until you realize that this is the cornerstone on which the fulfillment of the old begins. Yeah. And so it is a new Genesis. It's also a new Exodus, a new Moses who brings it about. But what Matthew privileges and emphasizes from the beginning through the middle to the end, more than the other three evangelists, is the kingdom of David, the Davidic kingdom covenant. And so you have lots of, you know, lots of beautiful echoes of new Genesis, a new creation, a new Adam, as it were. But oh, the best part is the Davidic kingdom.
My guest is Dr. Scott Hahn, covenant theologian, biblical theologian, teacher, catechist, prolific author, and we're talking about the St. Paul Center's recent course, The Gospel of Matthew, part of their Emmaus Academy. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
This program brought to you in part by Ave Maria, Florida, a big kind of small town, where golf carts take you everywhere and there's always something fun around the corner. Discover championship golf, resort-style amenities, and a town center full of shopping and dining. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at its heart, it's a community full of connection and charm. More than 25 model homes are available for viewing. More information can be found at avemaria.com. That's avemaria.com.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
You remember the time I said on the air, go to confession, and when you're done, go out and have a big ice cream soda. Celebrate. And a man wrote to me, he says, you know, I hadn't gone to confession in 30 years. Do you mind if I went and had a pizza? I said, oh, have 20 pizzas.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Pope Francis said, the key that opens the door to faith is prayer. Join St. Paul Street Evangelization by running a prayer station in the public square. You don't need to be a professional apologist or theologian. Just listen to the needs of the people you encounter. Offer encouragement, take prayer requests, and pray with people. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popcheck.
We'd all love to do more to serve others, but where do you find the time? Well, it's easy if you remember that Christian service begins at home. Remind your family that everything God's given you is meant to be passed on to other brothers and sisters in the Lord when you're done. Encourage your family to take good care of the clothes, toys, furniture, and other blessings you've been given so that others can delight in them when it's their turn. Then, once per season, as a family, gather the gently used clothes, toys, and other goods you've finished enjoying and bring them to your parish or other community center that can donate them to other families who are waiting to be blessed as you have been. To discover more ways your family can celebrate the liturgy of domestic church life, check out the newest editions of Parenting with Grace and visit CatholicCounselors.com. I'm Dr. Greg Popcheck, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Christ is the answer, with Father John Ricardo.
I repeat, I'm sure ad nauseum to the guys who are here, a line from Pope Benedict Emeritus now, who used to say over and over again, to be a Christian is not the result of an ethical choice, but the result of an event, an encounter, a meeting with the living God in the person of Jesus Christ. This and nothing less is what it means to be a Christian. So we said the new evangelization is new in ardor. That's a kind of old-fashioned word. What in the world is ardor? Ardor is zeal, fervor, passion. Are you passionate about Jesus? Passionate about Jesus? Are you zealous for Jesus? Are you fervent for Jesus? Are we fervent for the gospel? Are we passionate about helping this world come to know him?
You're listening to the 2025 Ave Maria in the Afternoon Year in Review.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. I'm speaking with Dr. Scott Hahn. He's a theologian, scripture scholar, teacher, and through the St. Paul Center that he runs and founded, there is a new course that's been put out on the Gospel of Matthew, and that's what we're talking about today. So, Dr. Hahn, I want to pick up where we left off. You dropped this bombshell on us, and then the break hit, about Matthew beginning with the words Biblos Genesios. But it's not just the book of Genesis, it's the book of the Genesis of Jesus the Christ. And so he makes these powerful, startling, messianic claims. I remember encountering it for the first time and realizing he makes it in an almost ho-hum authoritarian manner, And he makes it presuming that he has this authority to say this, and he's saying this because it's true. So Jesus the Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham, and directly shows that this is the person all the sons of Abraham have been awaiting.
That's right. You know, and what you have in the evangelist, St. Matthew, is by universal consensus of the tradition, you know, Levi, a scribe, a tax collector. So someone who obviously has honed his own scribal skills. And as we see in the TV series, The Chosen, mm-hmm. he may have been tapped to really keep track from the very outset right. of Jesus' public ministry. But regardless, you get a sense that in that first chapter where you have the genealogy going all the way back to Abraham, there is a numerical symbolism. You have three right. sets of 14 generations yep. from Abraham to David, 14, from David to the exile, 14, and from the exile to Joseph and Mary, 14, followed by the Annunciation to Joseph. Luke, of course, gives us the more familiar Marian Annunciation, yep. but you see here all of these things leading straight to the angel's proclamation to Saint Joseph. Right. And when you look at the reason why, well, in Hebrew, you don't have numbers. You assign numerical values to the letters of the alphabet right. concerning where they emerge. And so David's name consists of three letters that add up to the number 14. Now, Matthew never mentions this explicitly because his original readers didn't need anybody to do this. And so once you get behind the curtain, once you pick up on the behind the scenes, you realize why it is that though he emphasizes the Abrahamic covenant, the Mosaic covenant, he really privileges the Davidic covenant yes. as the main event. And in terms of salvation history, the Davidic covenant is the final form of the covenant that brings us to the threshold of the New Testament. Right. And so Son of David, in fact, the term kingdom, Basileia, occurs 60 times, and the kingdom of heaven, 33 times. So you have this emphasis that this is not simply a political restoration. This is really the fulfillment of the earthly prototype right. of the Davidic dynasty in the heavenly Jerusalem. And God is with us back then. God is with us in a new way through the incarnation. But Matthew, again, is the only one to give us the Great Commission. Go and make disciples of all nations, and no wonder, because the Davidic kingdom was not just one nation. Mm-hmm. It was one nation ruling all of the other nations, as we sing so frequently in Psalm 2 and yeah. elsewhere. ask him to make all the nations your inheritance. So the international breadth of the church is already prefigured in the covenant with Abraham. All the nations of the earth will be blessed through you, but especially the royal family of David. And when you pick up on all of these sub-themes, you end up seeing something emerging with a composite unity that, again, just takes your breath away, and you realize this man was not only a literary artist, not only an eyewitness, one of the 12, but someone who must have been a contemplative, a theologian himself, who basically applied himself to the study of the law and the prophets to illustrate exactly what Jesus says in Matthew 5:17, think not that I've come to abolish the law and the prophets, I've come to fulfill. And that pattern of fulfillment, pleirosis, just really turns the Gospel of Matthew into something three-dimensional.
Right.
It comes alive, and it's just such a beautiful thing to see students discovering this for the first time, along with all of these other unique features to Matthew. Matthew, for example, is the only one who gives us the Lord's Prayer in its fullest version. You mentioned the you've heard that it was said to men of old, but I say to you, those six antitheses are only found in Matthew's gospel. The eight Beatitudes are only found in Matthew's gospel. The Magi following the star to Bethlehem. Again, these distinctive features that emphasize certain aspects of his own approach to Christ, the Son of David, the Son of God, the King of Israel. And so you have this kingdom of David restored, but the kingdom of David ends up becoming what we would call the Catholic Church,
right?
Especially Peter. And we could talk about this later on, perhaps, but Matthew is also nicknamed not only the Gospel of the Church, because he's the only evangelist to use the term ecclesia three times, but it's also known even among Protestants as the Gospel of Peter. Peter walks on the water, only in Matthew. Thou art Peter, and upon this rock I'll build my church, only in Matthew. The keys of the kingdom, only in Matthew. Paying the half shekel tax, that Peter passage is only found in Matthew. Jesus says you have to forgive your brother seven times, but in Matthew 18, he says to Peter, you must be willing to forgive 70 times seven in a way that is godlike, the way God forgives his people their iniquities. And again, when you pick up on these strands, you find that this threefold cord, this evangelical rope, if you will, is such a solid way to build your relationship with Jesus upon a close and prayerful study.
You know, you pack a lot into a short amount of time, Dr. Hahn, and I want to really zoom in on this concept of liturgical kingdom that really comes out in the Gospel of Matthew that you touch upon in your lesson. So he begins with that gematria of David. Jesus is the most David of the Davids, you know, 14, 14, 14. And then he appeals to terms like ecclesia, no one else does that, basileia for the kingdom. And then the Petrine primacy that comes out in the text. I remember encountering Matthew 16 in juxtaposition to Isaiah 22 and realizing you really get a sense of what Matthew is trying to do in the way he thinks about the new and eternal Davidic kingdom.
It's so true, Marcus. You know, I wrote a commentary several years ago on an Old Testament book known as Chronicles, 1 and 2 Chronicles. The title of that is The Kingdom of God as Liturgical Empire, because that's the chronicler's historical and theological perspective. And, you know, in many collections of the Old Testament canon, Chronicles is the last book. And so you would find that if Matthew had that sequence, then the Old ends with Chronicles, and then the new begins with Matthew. And when you look at the resemblances, it's just downright striking, because Chronicles begins with a comprehensive genealogy that goes all the way back to the book of Genesis, but emphasizing the Davidic genealogy,
right,
and at the same time acknowledging the exile, the collapse of the kingdom, the defeat of Jerusalem, and the destruction of the temple. So God's people are in exile, reading the story as though it's in search of an ending, and then Matthew says, I'll pick up where the chronicler leaves off. And this emphasis on the kingdom, not as primarily political or military, but liturgical, that the Levites are now reorganized, basically perpetual adoration, 24/7 at the time of the temple. David's greatest contribution is not military, but basically reorganizing the worship of the 12 tribes, and then Solomon, his son, imparting divine wisdom and inviting Gentiles up to the holy city to learn the ways of God. It ends up showing that the Davidic kingdom covenant really was divinely intended to be a prototype of the Catholic Church. And so when you read it in that sense, you realize, okay, why does Matthew alone give us the Sermon on the Mount? Why does Matthew alone emphasize and tell us what Jesus said? I've not come to abolish the law and the prophets, but to fulfill. Now, all of the other evangelists illustrate that, but only Matthew has Jesus explicitly and emphatically stating it. And Matthew then illustrates it so beautifully.
My guest is Dr. Scott Hahn. We are talking about the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology's recent course on the Gospel of Matthew that's put out via their Emmaus Academy platform. It's a wondrous exploration of this gospel that paves the way for the exploration of the other gospels. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Steve and Janet Ray here, announcing we are back in the Holy Land, ready to introduce you to our favorite places in the world, the land where God walked. Mass at the most holy sites, pray the mysteries of the rosary where they happened, and experience the Bible in vivid color. We have led over 100 groups through this land, sharing the whole story of salvation. Of all the pilgrimages in all of the world, this is the one you should not miss.
Find the Ave Maria Radio travel tab at avemariaradio.net.
This program brought to you in part by Ave Maria Florida, a big kind of small town where golf carts take you everywhere and there's always something fun around the corner. Discover championship golf, resort-style amenities, and a town center full of shopping and dining. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at its heart, it's a community full of connection and charm. More than 25 model homes are available for viewing. More information can be found at avemaria.com. That's avemaria.com.
60 on 10 with Monsignor Charles Pope.
The Eighth Commandment: you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. At one level, the reputation a person has is one of their most precious gifts, and to intentionally harm the good reputation of someone is a very grave matter. We can do this often through detraction, by disclosing others' faults without a valid reason, or calumny, just outright lying about other people, likewise through rash judgment. This commandment also protects the truth, which is another very, very great good. To lie is to speak something that we know is false with the intention of deceiving others. We ought to be dedicated to the truth. It is the truth that sets people free, while errors and lies entrap people in many difficult and often sinful situations. The Lord asks us to give witness to the truth of the gospel. This commandment therefore asks us to stay dedicated to the truth and to other people's reputation. The Eighth Commandment: you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor.
For more about the Ten Commandments, visit EWTNRC.com.
When and how did Jesus allow some of his apostles to see him in his glory? After entrusting to Peter the keys to govern the house of God, the church, the Lord began to reveal to his followers that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things, including death, but that on the third day he would be raised from that death. It is during this period, according to the Catholic Catechism, that he takes Peter, James, and John up on a high mountain and there unveils his divine glory for a very brief time. His clothing, his face become dazzling with light. He also reveals he must go by way of the cross in Jerusalem to enter his glory. All the Trinity is present for the Transfiguration: the Father in the voice declaring Jesus to be his beloved Son, the Son in Jesus, the Spirit in the cloud that covers Jesus. The Transfiguration gives us a window on Jesus' glorious coming and our own transformation from a lowly body to a glorious body like His. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
You're listening to the 2025 Ave Maria in the Afternoon Year in Review.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Pete. I'm speaking with Dr. Scott Hahn, theologian, scripture scholar, prolific author, and the teacher of this recent course put out by the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology via Emmaus Academy called The Gospel of St. Matthew. And Dr. Hahn, I want to pick out one of the themes that you mentioned earlier, kind of sub-theme, if you will, and that has to do with the person of Joseph, who, like you mentioned, it's a gospel of Peter. He holds a place of primacy throughout the gospels. But Jesus' kingly authority is appealed to in a very decisive manner through this man who is Sadiq, this righteous man named Joseph, through whom Jesus has rightful claim to the Davidic throne. I'd like to pick up from there.
Yeah, and Marcus, let me just inject something here, because you and I both know about the Ignatius Catholic Study Bible and how extensively I'm drawing from the notes at the bottom of the pages of the Ignatius Catholic Study Bible. And in case it's news to people, I just want to also mention that the entire Bible is now complete. Yeah. It was published less than 6 months ago, both Old Testament and New in one volume, and I'd invite people, if they're interested in this course on Matthew, to get a copy or to consult their own copy if they already have one. Just talked to Ignatius yesterday, and in less than 6 months, they have sold 115,000 copies. Mm. We're having trouble keeping it in print. It's something of a phenomenon, a literary sensation. And I say this because if somebody would just go to the stpaulcenter.com, they'd find on the surface, it would appear as though this course is behind a paywall. Mm-hmm. But I want to mention two things. Number one, if you go to the St. Paul Center website, stpaulcenter.com, you'll see on the home page a sign pointing to these courses on the gospel and mine on Matthew. And you'll discover that if you enroll in the Emmaus Academy, you get your first 30 days free. And you can just basically go through this course and figure out if you want to stay subscribed. There's another thing, too, that is, if you don't have a copy of the Ignatius Catholic Study Bible, or if you wanted to get one for a family member or friend, you'll get it free simply by signing up to All Access membership on the Emmaus Academy. Then you get my course on Matthew and the other three Gospels as well. Over 30 courses taught by master teachers, including me and Bergsma and so many others as well. So I just want to make it clear to people that they could begin this today. They don't have to wait for it. And it'd be a great way to kind of start off the second half of this wonderful year of Jubilee. But since you asked about Joseph, Joseph is a figure who is more prominently featured in Matthew than the other three Gospels put together. On the one hand, he points backward, because in Genesis 37 and following, you have this key patriarchal figure by the name of Joseph first. He is the son of Jacob second. He's described as a tzaddik, as you put it, Marcus, a righteous man. He's misunderstood, misrepresented, but God protects him and gives him a series of dreams, the result of which the holy family of Israel ends up in Egypt in a time of trouble for food provisions of bread. And then when you look at what is distinctive to Matthew, you have Joseph, again, the same name, the son of Jacob, the same name for his father, and then likewise he's described as a righteous man, as a tzaddik. He's misunderstood by his own contemporaries. He's given a series of dreams, and only in Matthew's gospel do you have the flight to Egypt, because he takes the Holy Family where? The last place you'd expect, and that is the land of Egypt, to set the stage for a new Exodus, a greater Exodus than the one that Moses was basically bringing about through God's power. And so this sets the stage for a new Moses, a new Passover, a new Exodus as well. But as you mentioned, pointing forward, what you also have is the angelic annunciation, where in fact the angel is speaking to Joseph, who has heard that Mary is pregnant by the Holy Spirit, And the notes explain why he's not suspicious of her infidelity.
Right.
He's reverent and humble and mindful of his own unworthiness. And so when the angel approaches him, he doesn't say, "Joseph, son of Jacob, don't be suspicious. You ought to know she's a fine woman." No, it's Joseph, son of David. David's not Joseph's dad, but it is his dynastic dignity.
Right.
And the genealogy proves the fact that Joseph is the one who bears the torch and will hand it off by naming Jesus. And that is a legal act in Jewish tradition that basically identifies the father. And so you find in Luke 2, Mary asking Jesus, "Why did you put your father and me in such distress?" You know, when he was found in the temple. Not foster father, and not simply legal father, but there is a true and covenantal sense in which he reflects God's own virginal paternity in bearing the son of David, who is also the son of God. Layer after layer, there's a profound sense of typological polyvalence.
Yeah.
So that you have new creation, new Adam, you have new Exodus, new Moses, but you especially have Matthew emphasizing new kingdom, new Jerusalem, and thus a new and greater than Solomon. Again, a distinctive feature of Matthew's gospel, which will only enrich your appreciation for Mark, Luke, and John as you discover what is peculiar or distinctive in their emphases as well.
And this greatly echoes the Israelite anticipation for the royal Messiah to come, you know, that this new David, this new son of David, would bring forth an age of blessings, you know, Makarioi, the Ashrei, the blessings that would come forth from him as being a true son of David. But we also have in Psalm 1 in the wisdom literature this allusion that and even the rest of the Psalms, that the son of David would be a kind of son of God. And so Matthew is making that direct appeal, not just through the image of Joseph and Jesus' heritage, but because he's truly God made man.
You put it well. And I think it's important to see that in the old, you have the prototype. You have the son of David, Solomon, the first to be called son of God,
right,
by the grace of a divine adoption, whereas the new fulfills the old, not just by pressing reset or returning to the status quo ante before the exile, but you see instead that the Son of God from all eternity is becoming the Son of David. So retiring, in a sense, the human or the merely earthly prototype, mm-hmm, there in the earthly Jerusalem, and setting the stage for fulfillment that really exceeded the highest hopes of the Hebrews. Even the holiest of the Hebrews had no idea what was happening, and yet you go back and read Isaiah or Jeremiah or Ezekiel, and you realize that they were pointing forward to the Messiah, not supplying proof text primarily, but typological layers, so that you can see the typology is already embedded in the messianic oracles of the prophets. As Cardinal Danielou said, prophecy is nothing other than the typological interpretation of history, not just pointing back to the old, but in the old, Isaiah and Jeremiah and the other prophets are pointing forward to the coming of the Messiah, mm-hmm, the establishment and fulfillment of the Davidic kingdom, as involving nothing less than what? A new creation, as Isaiah says, a new heavens and a new earth. Likewise, a new and greater Exodus. The Messiah will be greater than Moses, just, yep, as Moses had predicted in Deuteronomy 18, and likewise, the new David, the new Jerusalem. You find this especially in Isaiah, from whom Matthew draws in a way that is truly unprecedented. But it's also in Jeremiah, in, mm-hmm, Ezekiel, and Moses is pointing forward to it as well. So it isn't where the prophets break from the law. It's what you find in the Pentateuch taken up to the next level and fulfilled beyond their wildest dreams. And again, it makes Scripture come alive, but it also echoes the experience that Clopas and his companion had on Easter Sunday when they said, "Did not our hearts burn within us as he opened up the Scriptures?" Yeah. And yet reading the Bible from the heart of the church always leads us back to Jesus in the Eucharist, so that our worship in the Mass always consists of word and sacrament. where we hear the old and the new, the promises of the old fulfilled in the new, but the fulfillment isn't simply a first century phenomenon. Mm-hmm. It's happening in the 21st century precisely with the words of consecration. The real presence of the Son of God, the Son of David, the Son of Abraham. And this is what makes the gospel so much more powerful when they illuminate the mystery of the Holy Eucharist, just as the Eucharist makes the scriptures more profound, because you're not just connecting the old and the new, yeah. You're connecting the document with the Blessed Sacrament. You're connecting Sunday with the rest of our week that will basically unfold beginning on Monday morning.
And that's why when you read the entire narrative, it's almost as if what's happening in Matthew 16 is paving the way for this new image. It seems like this is the climactic point that provides for us the lens, the paradigm for the telos of what the Messiah had always intended, this liturgical kingdom to be established in eventual sacrament.
Right, and prior to Matthew showing us Peter's declaration, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God, mm-hmm. who do men say that the Son of Man is? And they have recourse to what? The Old Testament. Some say John the Baptist, other Elijah, Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. And so at the heart of the Old Covenant is the sign that points to Christ, the Messiah, the Son of the living God. And so the grace that is given to Simon Peter to make this profession of faith in Jesus, the Son of God, the Son of David, the Messiah, you know, this is why Matthew, and again, only Matthew, goes on to say, you are Peter. You are the rock, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it, and I give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, etc. It's wonderful.
It truly is, and I could go on for hours. Thank you so much, Dr. Hahn, for making the time to speak with us.
Oh, what a joy. Thank you, Marcus.
My guest has been Dr. Scott Hahn, who is a prolific author and the founder of the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology. They've recently put out a course, The Gospel of St. Matthew, as part of the Emmaus Academy. Thank you for joining us. I'm Marcus Peter.